And have the ladies' guard given up as well? Are there none who would stand with the wild children of deviltry against the ladies' enemies? He waited, looking from face to face, then lowered his voice. Tomorrow, at dawn, the devils will be at Red Rock. We intend to drive the flesh-eaters from Whisperwood. If we have to fight the flesh-eaters alone, we will. But remember, if we should fall, so will you.
The elves' faces betrayed no sign, no emotion. Ulfgar clapped, laughing.
I see now. You've come here to amuse us with your jests, unless you truly believe there are those among the ladies' guard foolish enough to follow a little boy, a mere child who plays at being a warlord, into battle.
Playing? Peter grinned. Sadly, even play fighting the flesh eaters is more than the son of the horned one can claim.
Ulfgar stopped laughing. His face became hard, his dark eyes cold.
My father's clemency has spared you today, runt. But by my name, should I see you again in these woods, there will be no banter, only your swift death.
Ulfgar turned and headed back up the trail. The elves lingered a moment longer, staring at Peter with their narrow, cold eyes. Then they too disappeared up the trail. Three sharp raps hit the door. All the devils stopped what they were doing, looked at one another, then to the door. A large kid named Bear opened the peephole, and a big grin lit his face. He threw the slat over and pulled the round door inward.
Well, well, he said. Look what the devil dragged home.
Peter rushed past, to the middle of the chamber, raising his knife high.
Blood is clan, and clan is blood. All hail the lords of deviltry!
The devils dropped whatever they were doing, leaped to their feet, and shouted,
Blood is clan, and clan is blood!
They rushed toward Peter. Nick could feel the excitement in the air like an electrical charge. The devils danced and clamored around Peter as though he were the Messiah. Even the usually reserved Sikiyu beamed like a schoolgirl. The tall, lumbering troll came in quietly behind Peter and shut the door. No one appeared to notice nor care. He made his way around the kids and eased himself onto a bench near the roots. He sat with his long face in his large hands, looking haggard and defeated. Peter tried to speak, but the kids were all talking at the same time. Peter raised his hand and waited for the chamber to quiet down.
I'm sure you're all aware that things have become dire. The flesh-eaters burn Whisperwood. It's time for bold action and brave deeds.
Their faces grew somber.
That is why I took it upon myself to enter the Lady's Wood, convinced Tangnost that it was time to set aside old grievance and try to bring the clans together.
The troll rolled his eyes. Peter thumped his chest.
I braved the Lady's Wood, stood alone before Ulfgar and his horde of elves with nothing but my knife. And I challenged Ulfgar, dared him to stand with us against the flesh-eaters.
The devils held their breaths, leaned forward. Peter spat on the ground.
The coward refused.
Some of the kids booed. There were shouts of, Who needs him? But Nick also saw several troubled faces.
Don't fear, for I have a plan.
A devilish smile lit Peter's face.
Such a wicked plan. The devils will have their day of glory, this I promise.
Peter raised his knife above his head and shouted,
For who are the true guardians of the lady?
The kids erupted.
The devils! And who are the true lords of Avalon? The devils!
Peter held his hand up until the chamber again quieted.
As I'm sure you've all heard by now,
The devils stood against the witch today. They cheered. Held their own against Ginny Greenteeth's entire horde. More hoots and cheers. Not only that, but one of our new blood has proven himself worthy. In defense of his clan, he single-handedly killed 2 Barghest and saved the lives of 3 new bloods. Peter's voice dropped.
Devils, prepare.
2 devils ran around the chamber, dousing the torches and lanterns until only a single torch burned on the central pillar above Peter's head. Sikiyu handed Peter a tattered gray wolf pelt. Peter slipped it over his head like a hood, so that his eyes peeked out from the mask. Peter hopped up onto a stone at the pillar's base. He threw his arms up with a theatrical flourish. The chamber fell dead quiet.
Bring me the body of Leroy!
Leroy looked both delighted and terrified. Redbone and several of the devils grabbed him and jostled him over to Peter. The devils formed a semicircle, all facing Peter. Sikiyu brought Peter a knife and sword, both in scabbards and tied to a wide studded belt. Peter slid out the knife, held it before Leroy's eyes, letting the flicking torchlight dance along its sharp edge.
Leroy, do you give your blood to the devils?
Leroy looked at the knife and hesitated, finally letting out a timid,
yes. All have heard. He gives his blood willingly,
Peter cried. The devils began to clack their teeth. Leroy glanced about, eyes wide. Nick could see he was breathing fast.
Hold out your hands,
Peter said, his golden eyes grave, almost angry. Leroy slowly brought up his hands. They were trembling. He winced. Peter laid the hilt of the knife in Leroy's palm, clasped Leroy's hand in his, so that together they held the knife.
This belongs to you now,
Peter said in a hushed, reverent tone. Leroy's face flushed with relief. He looked at the knife, overjoyed. Sikiyu handed Peter the sword and belt. Peter knelt and buckled the belt around Leroy's waist, then stood, clasping Leroy on each shoulder.
Welcome, brother. Welcome to the clan of Deviltry.
Leroy beamed.
One has put his life on the line for his clan, Peter shouted. Stood face to face against 2 Barghest. His reward is our brotherhood. Mark this day as the day Leroy earned the right to wear a sword, earned the right to be called a devil. Long live the clan of Deviltry!
The devils exploded in cheers and hoots. They snatched Leroy up onto their shoulders and began to parade him around the chamber, chanting his name.
I will claw out his eyes,
Nick hissed and clenched his hands into tight fists, digging his nails into his palms.
Burn his face. Stab him. Stab him. Stab!
Nick clamped his teeth together tightly.
What was he saying?
He shook his head, tried to clear away the acid, the venom. What had come over him? What was he thinking? He watched them tromp by, saw Leroy laughing and beaming with joy. Hatred swept over him again. He felt the frustration and anger welling up within him, and all at once a flush of heat bloomed in his stomach. The venom climbed up his throat.
That fucking shit! Dig out his eyes, tear his flesh, stomp his skull into the stones!
Nick clutched his head.
No,
he thought.
Fuck it. I don't give a fuck.
But another part of him did care. Cared very much. The pounding in his head grew worse. He wondered if it had anything to do with the poison from the Barghest. It felt more like in his dream, right before he'd turned into that demon thing. He needed something to drink. He glanced about, caught the troll watching him. He sucked in a deep breath.
Let it go, he told himself. Get some water. Cool down.
He got up and poured himself a mug of water, then headed over to the table, as far from everyone as he could get. The troll gave him a concerned look as he passed. Nick stared at the table, did his best to ignore the celebration. There was a nut pinned between the boards of the table, and he began to pick at it. Something, anything to keep his mind off Leroy, off the violence pounding in his head. The nut popped free. He batted it between his hands.
It's been a long day, that's all, he thought. Shit, between almost getting killed and all this bullshit with Leroy, well, being in a bad mood is understandable, right?
Two pixies alighted on the table, well out of arm's reach, and watched the nut. Tonight, Nick found he could hardly stand the sight of the little blue people. He swatted at them with the back of his hand.
Scat!
They stuck out their tongues and wagged their butts at him. Nick felt the heat grow in his stomach, the venom in his throat. He rubbed his head.
What's wrong with me?
Peter was talking to Leroy now. Nick stopped rolling the nut. Peter was obviously congratulating Leroy, pumping his hand up and down and patting him on the back. Leroy was all grins. Nick's lip quivered and his fingernails dug into the table. One of the pixies flicked Nick's ear while the other tried for the nut. Nick swatted violently at them. They flitted out of the way, giggling. Nick couldn't hear what Leroy was saying, but it was obvious by his exaggerated pantomimes that he was describing how he'd killed the Barghest. The heat in Nick's stomach began to burn, just like in the dream. And just like in the dream, he felt murder growing in his heart. Not just for Leroy, but for everyone. One of the pixies yanked a tuft of Nick's hair while the second one snatched for the nut again. And Nick felt the venom take him. He howled and hurled the mug at the pixie. It struck the pixie in midair, knocking it to the ground. The mug clanged across the stone floor. The hall fell silent. The pixie screamed, and the cry of pain brought Nick back. Nick watched it, fluttering, trying to get up. It was hurt.
Had he done that?
Yes,
he knew he had. But how could he have done such a thing? How could he have lost control like that?
He heard Cricket gasp and looked up. Everyone was staring at him. Redbone slid out his knife and started toward him.
No,
Peter said.
What?
Redbone said. He needs a lesson, needs a mark.
No,
Peter repeated. Sakiyu cleared her throat.
Nick will have to be killed.
No,
Peter said. Tagnost let out a sigh and thought,
this will not be easy.
He looked out over the ever-thinning canopy of leaves. The watchtower had always been a good place for counsel, a place to clear the mind. The bit of moon glow that found its way through the low-hanging clouds glistened silver off the dewy limbs. He saw a few fireflies and thought back to when the trees had been lush and the night alive with the glimmer of a million tiny fairies. Tagnost hooked his pipe in his mouth, inhaled deeply, then exhaled, watching the smoke drift away on the light breeze.
She's right, Peter. There's no other choice.
No,
Peter repeated.
He's turning, Tagnost said. And if we wait until it's too late, it'll be worse for all of us. If the kids see him turn, worse if they see us kill him, think what that will do for morale. We need to act now.
Peter pursed his lips and shook his head adamantly.
Nick is showing all the signs, Sakiyu said.
Peter didn't answer. He pulled his legs up to his chest, wrapped his arms around them, and put his chin on his knees.
Ever the contradiction,
Tengnost thought.
One moment a cold-hearted killer, the next a sentimental boy. Always the eternal optimist despite a lifetime of tragedy. Of course, that's his glamour. The very thing that draws the children to him, makes them love him despite so many contradictions.
Nick is having the nightmares, Sikiu said. I hear him at night. You can see darkness in his eyes in the morning.
Peter's brow tightened.
You saw him tonight, she said. He is having trouble controlling his anger. You know that is the last sign before they turn for good.
Peter looked up.
What, because he swatted a pixie? Who hasn't? The little pests will run over you if you don't.
No, Peter, Tangnost said. That wasn't a swat. I was watching him. The darkness had him. He meant to kill that pixie.
I found one dead the other night, Sikiu said. Someone had crushed it.
Peter looked at her.
What? No.
Yes.
He'll beat it, Peter said. We've had others that went through it. Older boys just starting puberty. Their bodies always fight the magic.
Yes, Sikiu said. But they do not go so far. One night, maybe two, of bad dreams and stomach aches, and that is all.
Tagnost sucked in a deep breath.
We can't risk another Roger.
There, he'd said it.
Not now. Not with everything at stake.
Sikiu gave Peter a hard look. Peter's face clouded. He looked away into the night sky. Tagnost knew it was cruel to bring up Roger. He hated having to, but he had to get through to Peter, and with Peter, sometimes this was the only way. Roger had been too old. Like with Nick, it started with the stomach aches, the dreams. Then he began to have violent outbursts. One moment, Roger seemed fine, then he'd lose control. He'd have that same confused look that Nick had, trying to understand why. Horrible thing to have to watch. Roger turned while out gathering berries. Sikiu told them one minute Roger was picking berries, the next he attacked another new blood, stabbed Sam over and over in the face, neck, and stomach. Sikiu had been the one to kill Roger, then had the task of putting Sam out of his misery.
Peter, I will not allow it to happen again, Sikiu said.
And the coldness of her tone chilled Tagnost.
If he shows any more signs, I will kill him.
No, I brought him through. If he turns, I'll be the one to kill him.
And if you are not there? Sikiu asked.
Peter set hard eyes on Sikiu.
If it happens again, kill him, Peter said bitterly. Make it quick, but kill him. Tell Redbone, but none of the others.
Sikiu nodded. She looked relieved. Peter hit the banister with his fist.
We can't lose him. We need him. If we're to defeat the Flesh Eaters, we'll need all of them.
An uncomfortable silence fell between them. Tagnost took another pull on his pipe.
Then it's decided?
Tagnost asked.
About the Flesh Eaters?
Peter nodded.
What other choice do we have? Food's almost gone. We can either try and drive the Flesh Eaters back, or fight Green Teeth and Ulfgar for the scraps left in their woods.
You spoke of a plan. A wicked plan, I believe.
Peter frowned.
Oh, that. He cleared his throat. Well, I'm still working on that.
He stood and began to pace back and forth.
Picking them off one at a time is no longer an option. We will never drive them back that way. There are just too many of them, too few of us, and too little time.
We need a new strategy.
What do you propose?
Peter nodded to himself, as though trying to convince himself of something. He crossed his arms over his chest.
An all-out assault.
Tangnost raised his shaggy eyebrows.
Peter, you know there are too many to...
We're out of time. If they break through Whisperwood, all will fall. What other option is there? Tell me.
Tangnost could think of nothing. Peter looked at Tangnost with grim, determined eyes.
It is the end, old friend. One way or another, it's the end.
Chapter 15 Marrow's Cove. Nick felt the heat swim through his veins like venom. The skin along his arms prickled, then began to burn, to shrivel and turn black right before his eyes. Claws grew out of his fingers, tore right through his flesh. He let out a long, painful wail, then saw them. Three little fairies no bigger than birds, and his wail turned into a deep, hungry growl. The fairies crouched in the crook of a tree, quivering, frozen in fear, fear of him. He smiled, felt his lips peel back over jagged teeth, and snatched up two of them. Slowly he squeezed them. Their eyes bulged and he felt their tiny bones crack and snap in his hand, their shrieks music to his ears. He bit off their heads, grinding their flesh and bones between his teeth, squeezed their runny guts into his mouth. Nick reached for the last one, the little boy. The boy screamed. Only it wasn't a little fairy scream that came out, but his scream, Nick's. Nick heard himself screaming and screaming with fear, with pain, with overwhelming loss. Nick awoke with a start, drenched in sweat, his stomach burning. This time the nightmares didn't fade. They'd been all too real, too vivid. He could almost still taste them. Nick didn't want to go back to sleep, afraid the dreams would return. He wondered why he was the only one that seemed to be having nightmares. He looked at Danny. The boy was sleeping like a baby. Danny had come in only a day or two before him. Nick unlatched his cage and got up. The first light of dawn was creeping through the windows, setting the thin mist aglow. None of the others were awake yet. He saw a few pixies flittering about here and there, scrounging around, searching for crumbs. They kept a wary eye on him. They're scared of me, he thought. This should have been good, but it made Nick feel as though something was wrong with him, like he had a disease, something contagious, something horrible. Nick stretched, surprised that his muscles weren't sore from all the hiking yesterday. If anything, he felt spry. He clenched his fist. He felt strong. He assumed it was the gruel. It really was doing something to him. And again, Nick had to ask himself just what that might be. He walked to the privy. The night chill still hung in the air, and the cool stones felt good beneath his bare feet. He entered, heard hissing, and saw the two pixies nesting just above him in the rafters, keeping a wary eye on him. Nick ignored them, dousing his head under the pump, and drank deeply, slowly washing away the fire in his stomach, the horrible taste from his mouth, then came back out into the chamber. He sat at the end of the long table and watched the morning light gradually fill the great hall. He stared at the straw men hanging in the shadows. They still reminded him of dead children. He found his thoughts returning again and again to his mother. In those last few years, he'd come to almost hate her. How? Why? Where had that hostility come from? Why was he always pushing her away, always making things so difficult? So many of their fights seemed so stupid now, so trivial. Absently, he stroked the soft fur of the blue rabbit's foot and recalled the days after his dad's funeral. He had been 10 then. Each night that week, a couple of NCO wives would drop off a few dishes for dinner. Sometimes they would bring along their children as well, each bestowing their condolences, wishing his mother the best in the coming months, making his mother promise if she needed anything, anything at all, to please just call. They could never stay long, though. They had kids to take to soccer or to swim team, or groceries to pick up. They'd leave their styrofoam takeout trays and head back to their homes, their lives, their husbands, leaving Nick and his mother alone in a room full of wilting flowers and sappy sympathy cards. It was then that it truly sank in that his father wouldn't be coming home, would never again walk through the door, plop down on the stairs and gripe about his day while unlacing his boots, would never again grab a beer out of the fridge, swat his wife on the butt, and ask what the heck was for supper, never again jab Nick in the gut and ask him if he'd beaten up any little girls at school. From now on, it would just be Nick and Mom. Those first nights, his mother had held him, rocking him gently as he cried himself to sleep. But now, while sitting in this gloomy chamber of stone and roots, he wondered just who had held her, who'd rocked her, wiped away her tears, told her everything would be all right. What had that been like for her, suddenly facing life as a single mom, with no one to turn to but an ailing mother in Brooklyn? And there were other matters, things grieving widows should never have to deal with. They could no longer stay on base, so she needed to find a place for them to live. And to add to that, the accident that had killed his father was under investigation, the army claiming negligence on his father's part. Nick understood little of the details, only that it had something to do with their benefits and meant his mother was suddenly desperate to find a job. And how had I helped? Nick asked himself. What did I do to make things easier? I argued, I complained, and I fought with her about everything. And worst of all, I blamed her for it all. He could hear his own whiny voice griping about his school, his room, his shoes, his stupid fucking shoes. God, how he hated the sound of it in his head. What had been wrong with him? Did he really believe he was the only one suffering? The only one hurting? Had he truly been that blind? Nick rubbed his forehead. Somehow everything had gotten jumbled up, twisted, that's all. The loss, the hurt, the anger, all of it. Now it seemed so clear, so goddamn painfully clear. I'm gonna come back, Mom, he whispered. Gonna make up for it. I promise. Just hang on. Please hang on. Nick pressed his hands into his face and tried to rub away the strain, the grief and regret. He heard a creak and looked up. Peter, Sikiyu, and the troll were coming down the stairs from the loft. All three of them were staring at him. Nick had the feeling that he was being scrutinized, almost examined. A smile lit Peter's face. Hey, Nick, you doing okay? Nick stood up. Peter, we need to talk. Peter walked over and placed a hand on Nick's back. And we will, Nick, most certainly. But not now. Too many things afoot. Peter's golden eyes gleamed wickedly. There's blood to be spilled and throats to slit. Peter threw his head back and crowed like a rooster, crowed until everyone in the chamber was on their feet. Kids lined up in front of the privy. Fires were set, torches lit, porridge put to boil. You could feel the excitement as the devils rushed about getting the day going. Nick got his bowl and took a seat next to Cricket and Danny. Danny looked in his bowl and frowned.
That's all we get? There's hardly enough to fill the bottom of my bowl.
What are you complaining for? Cricket asked. I thought you hated this gunk.
Wow, would you look at that?
Danny said. He was holding his glasses away from his face, pulling them off and on and squinting. He looked straight up. Cricket and Nick looked up too.
Danny?
Cricket asked. What the hell are you doing?
How about that?
Danny said.
I can see better without my glasses now. This magic porridge might taste like bark, but man, is it good for you.
He stood up, turned sideways, and pulled his shirt up.
Check this out.
He patted his stomach.
My gut's almost gone.
You're sucking in, Cricket said.
Am not. I'm turning into a lean, mean killing machine.
Please, Cricket said, slapping the table and letting out a laugh.
You know, Danny continued, if we could figure out the ingredients to this slop, we could make, like, a couple million bucks back home.
We're not ever going back home, Cricket said, and as the profoundness of her words hit them, they all fell quiet.
I am, Nick said. I'm getting out of here.
Cricket and Danny stared at him.
What do you mean?
Cricket asked.
I mean, I'm going home.
He paused. I have to get back to my mom. One way or another, I have to.
How you gonna do that?
Danny asked.
I don't know yet.
A sad smile crossed Cricket's lips. She reached out and clasped Nick's hand.
I'm sure there's a way.
Devils!
Peter called out.
Gather round. There is a tale to tell.
Peter took a deep breath. The devils clustered about him in a semicircle, sitting on the stone floor, atop their cages, or leaning against tree roots, goading and picking at one another. He looked from face to face. Cutter, who'd walked through the mist without so much as a word. Huck, who'd actually laughed at it. Dirk and Dash, who were always fighting with each other, but were never apart. Ivy, with her beautiful curly hair and one lazy eye from where her mother had kicked her for wearing makeup. Amos, the Amish boy who was banished for being too profane. How similar they were to the devils from the first age, before the great battle, to those boys and girls who died so valiantly. Peter leaned over to Tangnost.
They're ready. As ready as they'll ever be. Are you?
The old troll huffed and pushed himself to his feet.
No, but I'll do my best.
He walked in front of the devils, drew himself up to his full height, and stamped his staff once, hard, the sound reverberating about the chamber. The chattering died down.
This is not an easy tale to tell,
Tangnost began, his deep baritone filling the chamber.
Maybe if the words had been passed down to me from another. But this isn't some ancient, dusty legend. This is a real-life tragedy, and I was there to witness it. I saw the carnage, heard the screams, smelled the blood, and have no desire to relive the horror once again. I've done that enough in all the nightmares that have plagued me since. But you are being asked to put your lives on the line for Avalon. You deserve to know the truth, to know what you're fighting for. So it is time to tell the tale once more.
The troll cleared his throat.
We've new blood among us. For those of you to whom this story is new, it should enlighten you and hopefully inspire you. For those who've heard it not once, but many times, it should serve as a reminder of who we are and why we carry on. For me, it's important to pass down the events of that terrible day so that the deeds of those who died are not forgotten. This is a tale of evil, of death, and of heroism. It is my tale. It is your tale. This is the tale of the Flesh Eaters.
The hall fell quiet. All the kids leaned forward.
Before forever ago, the very earth itself was alive, a place of mystery, nature, and magic. It was the time of the first races, when gods still walked among us and we rejoiced in their miracles and wonderment. Mankind shared this world for but a blink. Then, sadly, they became enlightened, found science and religion. The new world of men left little room for magic or the magical creatures of old. Earth's first children were driven into the shadows by flame and cold iron, by man's insatiable need of conquest. Those who could escape mankind's persecution gathered around the Lady of the Lakes, Lady Modron, daughter of the great Avalok. She released the mist to hide and guard Avalon, and the isle became a refuge, a sanctuary from the human world. There is a sacred spot within Avalon, the Haven. At its center lies Avalok's tree. Its roots bind all of Avalon together. It is said that Avalok's blood courses through its roots. The tree is the heart, Avalon is the body, the inhabitants the soul. All three woven together, one living entity. One cannot be without the other. You are all part of this union.
Tangnost looked out past the kids, his eyes focused beyond the hall.
It was some time after the betrayal of King Arthur and his round table of villains that Avalon began to drift away from human civilization. The Isle left the Britons, drifting for an age along the frozen coasts of the Atlantic, until finally finding a home in the land now known as the Americas. This was a golden time for Avalon, for we were far away from mankind's intolerant god. This new land was still wild and full of magic, much like the early ages of Earth. The native people of the Americas were one with nature, both revering and fearing its magic. So, as time passed, we came to trust the peace, believe we were safe from the evils of human civilization. The lady called the mist back into the lakes, and once again the magical people had the stars and moon to dance under at night, and the sun to bask in during the day. The native people came and paid reverence to the lady. We shared our magic with their shamans and traded crafts, harvests, and wild game, just as we had with the druids of old. Then the ships came.
Tangnost paused, took in a deep breath.
One day I looked out toward the horizon, and there in Merrow's Cove, three tall galleons lay at anchor. Three ships full of men, women, children, dogs, pigs, fowl, goats, disease, and vermin. Their stench reached deep into the forest. I watched them wade ashore in droves, boatload after boatload. Close to 300 men and women landed, fouling our streams with their filth. Their priests planted a cold iron cross on the beach and tainted our land with their blessings. We'd fled to the farthest corner of the world to escape their tyranny, and yet somehow, here they were on the very shores of our sacred Avalon. All the magical creatures took flight at the sight of them. We hid far into the woods and watched from the hills. We hoped they'd take what they needed and leave. But instead they began to set up camp, and soon another ship came, and then another. Five ships sat in our harbor. How many more were on their way? We had no way of telling. The folk of Avalon held council with the lady. The lady sent a fellowship representing many of the fairy folk to meet with the men, to let them know that this was our land, and ask them to leave. The delegation was led by Hissy, the lady's lifelong friend and closest confidant. And I was proud to see my brother Tangrisnir there representing the trolls of Avalon. Dressed in their best finery, they all marched under the banner of the lady that day, each carrying a gift of fruit gathered from the lady's own garden. We watched from the woods as the delegation went forth. A group of women were washing in the stream, and when they saw the troop approaching, they began to shout and scream, then fled back into their camp. The delegation halted. They seemed unsure of what to do. Dozens of the men began to gather along the edge of the camp, shouting and yelling at the group. This went on for some minutes. Then all at once, several loud pops and plumes of white smoke erupted from the camp. I didn't know it at the time, but it was musket fire. Several of the delegation collapsed and didn't get back up. The rest ran for the woods. Hissy fell over, clutching his chest. Tangrisnir picked Hissy up and tried to carry him away. But the men from the camp came for them with swords and pikes. The delegation was unarmed, as they had come only to talk and parley. Those that were not fleet enough were run down and slain before our eyes. I watched my own brother stabbed over and over. They killed them right in front of us. We fled into the hills, all terrified for our lives.
Tangnost cleared his throat and continued, his voice thick with emotion.
The lady released the mist to protect our shores, to hide Avalon, lest even more ships should come. The mist boiled up from the lakes and rolled out of the forests and hills like dragon's breath. By that night, the mist had surrounded the island and covered the sky. I've not seen the sun or moon since.
Tangnost stopped, seemed unable to continue. Peter leaped up and began to pace the floor.
That was only the beginning of the dark days ahead, he said, and cocked his head as though hearing something far away. When I think back to that time, it is the drums I hear.
Peter thumped his chest.
I can still hear them in my heart, for the lady called on the great horned one to come out of the forest and crush the men, to drive them from our shores and into the mist. He came from out of the deepest, darkest wood, his eyes flaming beneath the horned helm. He beat his war drum and called all the folk to arms. He called for them to remember how to use their horns, teeth, and claws, to remember how to be terrible, to remember what it is like to darken the earth with the blood of mankind. And hear this!
Peter stuck out his chest, his face beamed with pride.
The Horned One came here, to Deviltry. The Lord of Avalon came to us. He called for our swords, offered us a place among the fairy fold in return for our allegiance. Do you know why?
Peter looked across the faces.
Because the devils knew what it means to fight for your place in this wicked world. Because none had fought harder to escape the evils of men, and none were hungrier to rid our land of their stink. The Horned One knew this well. He, the Horned One, danced with us around the fire that night as we sharpened our knives and teeth. Our hearts were ignited. All the island was united beneath the Horned One's banner. Seelie and Unseelie alike dug out their weapons of old, dusted off their shields and armor, sharpened their swords and spears. We painted our faces, and all that night we beat our drums, howling and wailing, hoping to put the fear of ancient ones back in the hearts of the men and drive them into the mist. The warriors of Avalon gathered at the edge of the forest and awaited dawn's first light. But the invaders didn't leave. Instead, they dug trenches and hid within them. When the first glow of dawn lit up the misty morning, the great horned one walked out of the forest and stood before us like a mighty oak. The morning light glistened off his majestic antlers. He beat his fist twice upon his chest and raised his mighty sword, Caliburn, high above his head. Horns rang out all along the forest line. When he brought the sword down, we charged. Elves, gnomes, minotaurs, centaurs, all manner of fairy folk, trolls, even the goblins had answered the Horned One's call. Never before had such an army been seen. I'll never forget that day, as ageless enemies put aside their differences to come to Avalon's defense. We were here to save our very world. I knew there'd be 1,000 songs sung about this legion, and was proud to count myself among them. My senses were alive. Never had the dew smelled so fresh and the air so crisp. I raised my sword, howled, and followed the Horned One into battle. Peter snatched a spear from the wall, pointed it at an imaginary foe. We charged, well over 500 strong. Such a sight we made, rushing down upon the enemy with weapons high and banners waving, and such a sound like thunder as we beat our swords and spears against our shields, and none howled louder than the devils. We were hungry to paint the tide red with the blood of the invader. We bore down upon their camp, and yet still they waited in their trenches. We thought them too scared to meet us on the battlefield. We were from a different age. We knew nothing of modern warfare, of fighting with muskets and cannon.
Peter's voice dropped.
All 5 ships gave us a broadside. The thunder of those cannons was so loud that at times I swear I can still hear their echo. I saw limbs torn from bodies, bodies turned to meat. Whole heads disappeared in a spray of blood.
His voice broke.
Never had I thought such carnage possible. Those not killed or maimed in the first volley were lost in shock, not knowing to run or fight, unable to even understand what was happening. Too many just stood there with wide eyes and were cut down as volley after volley ripped through our ranks. The air came alive with their screams, their cries of pain and terror. But, Peter said, his voice swelling with pride, not the devils. No, we did not lose our wits. It was us that stood beside the Horned One. We that did not waver. He continued to push ahead, and we followed. The men behind the trenches stood and began shooting their muskets, and it was only then that the devils began to lose our numbers. The Horned One was hit repeatedly, and still he continued forward. He climbed the embankment and attacked. They paid the price then. The men screamed and ran from his blazing eyes and terrible sword as he waded through them, cutting them down by the dozen. The devils rallied and came to his side, and that was when we heard the thunder, when the very earth erupted beneath our feet as cannon shot exploded all around us. When the smoke cleared, the Horned One was lying still upon a mound of scorched earth, his body blown to bits, around him the bodies of our clan.
Peter slammed the spear down across his knee, splintering the staff into 2 pieces. The devils started.
The men had killed the Great Horned One. They slaughtered my clan.
Peter's chin fell to his chest. He closed his eyes and could still see their faces, their mangled, shattered bodies, smell the stench of charred flesh. The rest was a jumble. Sikiyu helping him back up the beach, thick, choking smoke, pain, the endless ringing in his ears, the two of them stumbling toward the forest, trying not to slip in the pools of blood and gore as they climbed over the bodies of the dead and dying. Tangnost spoke up then, low, but the hall was so quiet, not a word was lost.
The story didn't end there. If only it had. Those that survived fell back into the hills, crawling into holes, dens, and caves, or any place they could find to hide away and lick their wounds. We waited for the men to leave. We hoped and begged the ancient gods to chase them off, but they did not leave. Instead, they built their fort, cleared the land to plant crops and build pens for their livestock. And worst of all, they erected a Christ church, defiling the very sanctity of Avalon. Large platoons of men began entering the forest, never venturing far, but killing any creatures they found. And they ate what they killed. Not just the wild game, no. They ate the magical ones as well. And this, you might have guessed, is how we came to call them flesh eaters. Then they began to burn the forest. Why? I can only guess at the madness of these demons. To create a barrier between them and us, perhaps? Whatever the reason, they've become obsessed with clearing the whole island of our kind. To burn down every tree, burn out every hole and den where we might live or hide. Year after year, they burned more and more. At first we thought we could outlast them, thought maybe they'd wither and die as mankind do in the human world. But dying is not so easy in Avalon. We've no sickness or disease here. At least not of the kind found in the human world. And we don't age the same, either. Peter has been here since before the Romans entered Britain. Myself, I do not know. Mankind were still hairy beasts wearing furs and stone weapons when I was young. Some creatures live for millennia without aging at all. As you can see, I have grown old, while Peter never seems to age. Sikiyu and Abraham have been here over a century and have barely changed. That's just the way of fairy. This same magic, unfortunately, also keeps the flesh eaters alive. But the magic does more than extend the flesh eaters' lives. Because Avalon is enchanted, only those with a magical nature can live here in harmony. Children like yourselves are full of magic, but the men have turned. They've lost their magic to the fear and hatred they harbor for all that they can't explain, control, or understand. And so the magic twists them, blackens their hides. They sprout claws and horns and turn into the demons they truly are. So we began to understand our plight. Something had to be done or Avalon would be destroyed and lost forever. Some went to the lady, hoping she could unite the remnants of Avalon. But her grief was too great. The loss of Hissi, the Horned One, and so many magical creatures had driven her to despair. The elves told that she withdrew within the haven, slept in the pond beneath Avalok's tree. She'd become inconsolable, and it took all her remaining will just to keep the mist alive. Soon, Ulfgar forbade any to visit her. By then, the men no longer had reliable gunpowder, but even without their musket and cannon, they were far too numerous and formidable for a direct assault. There were a few vain attempts at organized resistance, but without the Horned One, they quickly fell apart due to mistrust and squabbling. The various folk of Faerie withdrew back into their own territories. Ulfgar took leadership of the Lady's Wood for himself and forbade any to enter or leave. Avalon had become awake. Decades passed, and the Flesh Eaters became bolder and bolder, their forays penetrating deep into the heart of Avalon. They met little resistance, and it became obvious that it was only a matter of time before they would discover Avalon's last sanctuary, the Haven, and thus the Lady and Avalok's tree.
Peter sprang forward, the fire back in his eyes. He pointed the spearhead at the kids. "And that, devils, is where you came in. Time moves faster in the human world, and during our strife the world had moved on. Great cities had sprung up, a civil war engulfed the America land, and as usual it was the children who suffered. I found the orphaned, the abused, the lost and starving, gathered together those who wished a chance at a better life, and were courageous enough to fight for it, and brought them here. It wasn't long before Deviltree again rung with the shouts and cries of sparring warriors. The devils were back and ready to reclaim Avalon. Tagnost set out seeking allies, those brave enough to stand with us. He went to the witch, to Ulfgar, but all they did was laugh. What, they asked, could a handful of throwaway children do against the Flesh Eaters? How could children dare hope to succeed where the Horned One had failed? They laughed at us while huddled in their dying, beleaguered forest. Well, the devils did not hide. No, we went to war, Peter said, slapping the flat of the spearhead into the palm of his hand with a loud smack. We played by our own rules, setting ambushes, tricks, and traps, going after the Flesh Eaters' crops and stockpiles. We harried the men at every turn, and soon it was the Flesh Eaters that were afraid. Afraid to come into the forest, afraid to leave their fort at night. The tide began to turn, and there was hope for Avalon once again. All because a group of ragtag children that nobody wanted or believed in came together and fought for the Lady. Because you, the Lords of Deviltree, would not give up. Will never give up! Peter stood, feet planted wide, chest out. My tale doesn't end there, for the end has yet to be written. He pointed with the spearhead. You are the writers of this tale now. How it ends is up to each of you. You're the Lords of Deviltree. The deadliest, most courageous warriors Avalon has ever seen. The proud defenders of the Lady and Avalok's tree. Make no mistake, it will not be easy. But if you are stout of heart, are valiant in your deeds, if you are dedicated to ridding Avalon once and for all of these demons, then this story will end well. For the world of Faerie is strong and resolute. Mark my words. Once the Flesh Eaters are gone, Avalon will heal itself. And from that day on, you'll be the true lords of Avalon. Your tale sung for 1,000 ages. Peter raised the spearhead and shouted, Blood is clan, and clan is blood. All hail the lords of Deviltree. Blood is clan, and clan is blood, the kids screamed and jumped to their feet, waving their fists and pogoing into one another. Peter leaped among them, spurring them on, thrilling in their furor as they shouted and howled. All but one, a boy with dark circles under his eyes and green shoes. sitting in the back by himself. Nick stood with Peter, the troll, and the other new blood upon the watchtower. It was another silvery gray day beneath the ghostly clouds of Avalon. He could see across the treetops, across the fog clinging to the lowlands, and across rolling hills and ragged cliffs. Between breaks in the haze, he could just make out the perimeter of the island, the impenetrable mist forming a solid wall of whiteness at the shoreline. Peter pointed to a jagged line of devastation that ran the width of the island, to the black smoke rising from along the edge of the forest. "The flesh eaters are burning down Avalon, tree by tree, even as we stand here." Nick stared at the blackened scar dominating the landscape, but didn't really see it. His thoughts were tangled around Tagnost's words.
"The magic poisoned the men, darkening their skin, growing scales and claws, turning them into demons."
"Just like in my dream," Nick thought. "What does that mean, then? That I'm turning into a flesh eater?"
Peter placed a hand on Nick's back.
"Do you see, Nick?"
Nick started. He hadn't been listening. Peter pointed.
"There, that inlet. That's the Marrow Cove. And just up past that ridge there, that's where the Flesh Eater's Fort lies."
Nick could see it now. A cluster of black specks surrounded by some sort of fortification. He could also make out what must be the rotting skeletons of the ships in the cove.
"From there all the way to the black smoke, all used to be a lush forest, home to a million fairy folk."
The burned lands ran the width of the island and came inward from the coasts. On one side of that line,